This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Donald Trump was in New Hampshire this week. The Republican presidential candidate spoke in Atkinson on every issue from media bias to immigration. Trump assured supporters that as president, he will negotiate countless wins for his party, including a repeal of the Affordable Care Act and a funding increase for defense.
We're going to have so many wins, they're going to be pouring out of your ears. You're going to get tired of winning. You're going to say, Mr. President, let's have a loss. This is getting boring. And I say, no, I won't do that.
Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton appeared in Manchester on Wednesday, where she was asked about her stance on the death penalty. Clinton said that while she supports capital punishment, she believes it's used too frequently.
I do not favor abolishing it, however, because I think there are certain egregious cases that still deserve the consideration of the death penalty, but I'd like to see those be very limited and rare.
Also this week, officials from coastal communities nationwide flocked to the Granite State to discuss climate change and rising sea levels. No presidential candidate accepted the invitation to attend, to the consternation of local leaders like Hoboken, New Jersey Mayor Don Zimmer.
Every presidential candidate should be looking at this issue. We're talking about 123 million people. We're talking about half of our country's GDP. I mean, it's economics.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, thank you. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks as always.
Good morning, Laura.
And with us now for a few moments to update us on two other major New Hampshire stories this week, NHPR reporter Paige Sutherland. And Paige, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you covered a big story yesterday, Paige, concerning a rape trial and two St. Paul students. This was the sentencing phase for the male student accused, Owen LaBrie. Just give us a little background on this story first, Paige, please.
Yeah, no, of course. In August, Owen LaBrie was found guilty of having sex with a minor. She was 15 at the time. He was a senior. She was a freshman. But the major charge, which is aggravated rape, he was found not guilty of. So when it came to this sentencing, he was facing up to 11 years of jail time. And so the judge gave him 1 year behind bars, along with 5 years probation, and he will also have to be on the sex offender list for life. And so this was something that kind of shocked the defense team. They kind of came in hoping for probation. They wanted counseling, community service, and so they were not expecting to get any jail time. But because they are appealing the charges to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, he was able to walk out of the courtroom on bail.
And just remind us of some of the particulars of this case, Paige. It was presented by the defense as sort of a hookup among two willing teens, part of this senior salute tradition at St. Paul's and so forth.
And yeah, so the defense, who was J.W. Carney, a big criminal defense lawyer, he basically painted it as LaBrie was the victim, that he was part of the school culture, that he kind of was one of the boys and got stuck in this culture. And so this senior salute, as they called it, was basically seniors tried to hook up with as many underclassmen as they could before they graduated. And so basically the defense blamed the school, saying they didn't do enough to stop this culture from happening.
And that didn't fly with the judge yesterday.
That did not. And the judge actually made some very critical statements during his ruling. He he kind of debunked Carney's statements about how it was consensual, they were friends, and the judge was saying that that isn't fair to say that. Although he was acquitted of aggravated rape, you could tell by the victim's impact that it was not consensual.
And the victim was there, and she talked about that impact, Paige.
She actually wasn't there. She was there through video, and it was a very heartfelt, emotional, a lot of crying video statement. But her parents were there. They both gave very heartfelt statements as well, and her uncle as well.
And you said the defense was shocked by this. They thought it wouldn't be a year behind bars. They said that, you know, losing the Harvard scholarship, having to register as a sex offender was enough.
And that was the thing, too, is they really tried to paint LaBrie as this athlete who was a leader on campus. He was part of the church. He had a great family. He was a scholarship student. They really tried to paint him as this great kid that was going to Harvard. And the thing that was hard there was the judge was like, you're not the victim here. And so that was what they were trying to get across was in his 40-page statement for the sentencing motion, he never said, I'm sorry, I hurt her, I feel bad. It was all about how is this affecting me, which the judge was not okay with.
Two sort of broader questions for you, Paige, please. And Dean, I might ask you about this too. First of all, what does this mean for St. Paul's? I mean, this sort of prestigious New England, beautiful school has been put on the front page of national newspapers in a way that no school wants.
Yeah, it's been very hard for the school. They've been very hush-hush about it because they just, you know, want to separate themselves from this trial. And it seems as though no one has come out and said it, but it seems as though lawsuits should be filed probably by both families.
Against the school itself for allowing this culture and these types of things to happen.
It seems very likely, yes.
Even though, Dean Spiliotis, I mean, you know, this happens at private high schools elsewhere in the country probably, and definitely college campuses because we read about it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that you read about, and it does happen at a lot of other private schools, high schools, et cetera, that particular age can be fraught with these kinds of situations. But I think there's interest because, you know, St. Paul's is such an exclusive boarding school. It's one of the most selective in the country. I think the acceptance rate is like maybe 15%, something like that. It'll be interesting to see if there's any impact on applications, particularly among young women. I think Paige is right. We're likely to see lawsuits from one or both sides against the school. You know, this may have a lasting impact. I know I was watching World News tonight on one of the networks, and it was a second or third story on World News. So,
really? Wow.
That's a tremendous visibility and not good publicity for the school. It's from sort of what I've picked up. It sounds like this has been a tradition for a long time. It's not clear exactly sort of what the intention of is. Is it a hookup thing, or is it just to spend time with underclassmen? That's underclass women. That's how they present it. The school presented it. But we'll see. I just think there's a lot of interest because it is such an exclusive institution.
And Secretary of State John Kerry went there.
Absolutely.
And other illustrious people in American political life. Yeah, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, bad publicity for the school aside, you always hope that these kinds of stories prompt not just St. Paul's, but, you know, the Concord community as a whole, other high schools to talk about what are we teaching our kids about consent? What are we teaching our kids about relationships? And you hope that it doesn't just turn into this, you know, trying to evaluate the reputation of the school. How does the school save its relationship? But actually, you know, can maybe prompt some meaningful conversation among teenagers about, you know, how to avoid these situations, what consent is. And so I would just hope, and I think a lot of people in the Concord community would hope that that kind of conversation can get started by something like this as well.
Sure, and we did a whole program on it once the August trial phase was over, and definitely a lot of people called in and said, yeah, we're having this conversation around our kitchen table for sure. Go ahead, Paige, you want to jump in?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with you, Kathleen, and I think that the focus here is not on St. Paul's because this is not unique to this school at all. It happens across the country. There's so many cases, whether it's private, public, it's happening. And so, like Kathleen said, hopefully it just puts a spotlight and makes this issue be addressed.
Well, one more question for you, Paige. Why is the use of a computer, electronic communication, so important in this case? I mean, that's how kids communicate, you know?
No, that's a good question. And it was interesting because the media that was covering, which was a lot, kind of didn't pay attention to the computer charge. And that was the only felony charge that he actually got convicted of. And basically that would have had a maximum sentence of 7 years. And that's where he gets the lifetime sex offender requirement. And so this charge basically was designed in statute by the New Hampshire legislature as a charge for pedophiles, you know, people who are trying to lure older men who are trying to lure in young women. And so that's what the defense was saying, was that these are two teenagers. They're talking on Facebook. This statute isn't designed for them. And so basically they appealed it and the judge said, no, you didn't state your case in trial. And so we can't scratch it off.
Yeah, these laws that came out of the John Lynch administration and former Governor Lynch really did push these much tougher sex offender laws, including use of computer to lure a minor. I think that's the language. And lo and behold, that's where Owen LaBrie got caught up.
And another thing the judge said when he denied the appeal was basically that a computer is easier to lure in a minor. There's no face-to-face contact. You can say whatever you want. Again, she was 15 years old. He was a senior, a star athlete, a leader on campus. He, if you saw his emails, he was very poetic, very enticing. And so it seemed as though the judge kind of agreed that, yes, the computer was an easy way for you to reel her in.
Well, another story that you covered, Paige, this week that I did want to talk about, and that's the fate of the Sununu Center in Manchester and a new report this week on what to do with it. Just remind us very quickly, Paige, some people might not know what the Sununu Center is.
Yeah, so basically it's the state's only juvenile detention center. It's located in Manchester. And the big problem, and it's been a problem for a couple years now, is the population is declining. Right now, only a third of the 144 beds are being used, and it's about 13 million to run it. And so basically the state, being fiscally conservative, wants to reduce their cost. And so they've been working on this committee. They've met about 10 times just trying to figure out long term how we can save some state dollars but still serve this population. And so there's been a few options laid on the table, but it seems as though the future of this center is something that's not going to be addressed until the next budget, which will be 2017.
What's the bigger budget picture on this, Dean? And you can see why lawmakers are looking at it. I mean, if only a third of the beds are filled, you've got this whole huge space that's not being used.
Right. And there was also this $5 million budget cut in the current budget. And if that's not restored, the facility is saying they may have to lay off half of the 120-person staff. You know, the longer-term budgetary issue is, as Paige was saying, how do you serve this population in a way that makes sense fiscally for the state's overall budget. And, you know, some of these different proposals, you know, you could develop this facility into some sort of other kind of residential treatment facility, but that could end up costing the state additional money. Or you could sell some of the property and maybe have a smaller facility. So I think a lot of what we're going to see going forward is figuring out how to use this facility in a way that makes sense for the target populations, but that also is not going to sort of bring the state into having to pay even more costs and overhead. They're already dealing again with this $5 million cut.
Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll just add that this $5 million budget cut that Dean mentions, it was kind of arbitrary. Essentially what the budget writers did is they said, we're going to cut $5 million from your budget and you have to come to us with a plan of how you're going to make that up. And I think that this is something that we see in budgeting a lot in New Hampshire. The legislature will just, you know, make a decision that X program is going to get X amount of money. And sometimes there's maybe not a full evaluation of how that program is going to make that work. And that's what happened here. They didn't, you know, spend time studying it before they made the appropriation. They made the appropriation and then said, okay, you go figure out how you're going to do this. And now there's kind of this back and forth between HHS, which runs the center, and lawmakers between, okay, how do we actually, you gave us this arbitrary number, how do we actually get there? And those are the, you know, do we privatize food services? Do we lay off staff? And so it's just kind of, it's just one example of the way that New Hampshire tends to budget sometimes. We've also seen it with, you know, the retiree health benefit plans. This particular amount of money was appropriated. It's not enough to do what needs to be done is the program is working now. So now lawmakers are left saying, okay, how do we get to that number that was set in the budget? And so it's complicated. And we're seeing this happen on a number of issues where lawmakers are now having to meet and kind of evaluate how these programs actually hit the targets that have been set in the budget.
And it's a state story, clearly, because this is the facility, again, for the state's juvenile delinquents. But it's also a local story, Paige, right? I mean, there's people in Manchester who live near this facility who aren't sure what they want it to turn into.
Yeah, what's interesting and was brought up, and it's kind of this new idea, is that the state doesn't have a lot of services when it comes to substance abuse and mental health for youth. And so one of their ideas was to kind of open up their empty space for juveniles that are not court ordered to be there and kind of, you know, offer nonprofits to come in and offer these services. So that's an idea that's completely new to the state, but also one that was very encouraged by the community because there is such a lack in the state for those services for that population.
Okay. Paige, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's NHPR's Paige Sutherland. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover some of the top stories of the week. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Well, Kathleen Ronayne, we recently celebrated Back to the Future Day, the year in that movie when the characters actually go towards the future. In October 2015, Back to the Future education funding lawsuit this week. Is this the same issue as the late 90s and early 2000s when property poor towns sued the state and won, saying, look, it's not fair, we're not getting enough, or is this a completely different issue?
It's pretty different. I mean, education funding as a whole, you know, for the past 20 years or so, it's always been this fight over our schools getting what they are fairly owed. And that, again, is the question here. But the specifics are a little bit different. So what happened is the city of Dover has sued the state, saying that they're not getting all the money they're entitled to provide an adequate education, which is something that's required by the New Hampshire Constitution. So,
and that did come out of this.
That did come out of the original Claremont lawsuits in the 90s. So right now, how New Hampshire funds education is districts get roughly $3,450 per student. They're paid on a per student basis. But several years ago, the legislature made some changes to the funding formula, and they put in place this cap that said no district can get more than 108% of what it got the year before. So in most New Hampshire school districts, this isn't a problem because enrollment is declining across the state. But in a district like Dover, as well as districts like Windham and Bedford, their school populations are growing, and they're growing faster than the 8%. So Dover is effectively saying, listen, this formula that you've put in place means that we're not getting all of that $3,450 per student. And so they've sued the state to say that the cap in place now is unconstitutional. And they're also seeking about $14 million in back payments from the state dating back to 2009. So there's a couple interesting things here. One, I think it's noteworthy that no other districts have joined in to with Dover, because this would have implications for districts like Windham and Bedford. But it seems like they're kind of saying, OK, let's let Dover take this fight, because if it goes in their favor, it's probably going to help us as well. The more interesting thing is that the Attorney General's office has said that they are not going to defend the cap as constitutional. And it's pretty rare for the AG to say, we're not going to defend state law. So they are going to fight against the back payments. They don't think that Dover should be entitled the back payments. And, you know, if Dover gets $14 million in back payments, that means all these other districts are going to seek back payments. And then we've got a pretty big budget issue that we're talking about here.
And you have other towns saying, hey, we'd like some back payments too.
Right. But the legislature has jumped in. Senate President Chuck Morse and House Speaker Sean Jasper have jumped in to say, well, if the AG's office isn't going to defend it, we're going to defend it. And then it also gets further complicated by the fact that the legislature in this budget is already moving towards raising the cap. In 2017, the cap gets raised to 160%, which is...
That's a big jump.
Yes, it's a big jump. And the legislature talked in the budget process about wanting to remove it altogether in future budgets. But obviously, they can't bind a future legislature. So they're already moving towards raising that. So I think the big question here... is really going to be about the back payments, because that could have serious, budgetary implications for the state if Dover is awarded those back payments. And I think we're going to see that some statements still have to be filed. Maybe in January or February, we'll start to see some that play out in court.
All right. Well, we'll close out this conversation hearing from Andrew Valinsky, who's representing Dover in this case, saying lawmakers aren't acting fast enough for districts whose schools are growing.
Dover has been very patient. Dover's had discussions with legislators, the governor, the commissioner of education about this cap since 2011, each year being promised that it would be removed the following year.
It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'll be back in a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to presidential politics, and as always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Kathleen Ronayne, Statehouse reporter for the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And with us now as we cover some political stories is Paul Steinhauser, political director and anchor at NH1 News. Paul, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Laura, thanks. Always great to join you.
So post-debate number three, Jeb Bush comes to the Granite State. And Paul, what are Mr. Bush's supporters saying about his campaign and some shakeups this week?
His supporters are still supporting him. That has not changed. I spoke to Chuck Morse yesterday. He's the state Senate president, obviously, a big supporter. He just endorsed him 2 weeks ago. And Chuck was telling me that, don't worry, it's still early. We've got 3 months to go. And that was the message from Jeb Bush yesterday as well, basically telling the political pundits who were writing his obituary following a very lackluster debate performance that Jeb Bush said, no, it's not over. He said, we've still got 3 months to go. I'm going to be campaigning. I asked him specifically, what do you do next? And he said, I'm going to do what I've been doing, but I'm going to accelerate it. I'm going to be campaigning the New Hampshire way. And he said, I'm coming back on Tuesday to kick off a bus tour.
All right. Well, at Gino's Chowder and Sandwich Shop in Portsmouth this week, following the debate, Jeb Bush said, being a good president is about more than standing out during debates. Let's hear.
It's not about the big personalities on the stage. It's not about performance. It's about leadership. And the leader today in this country needs to be a unifier.
The big personalities on the stage. I wonder who he's talking about, Dean. Jeb Bush. I wonder who he's talking about. He's probably talking about Donald Trump.
Oh, right. Absolutely. There's a number of people to choose from. There's Donald Trump, maybe not so much Ben Carson. A lot of this has all been driven by the debate that we just saw, the Republican presidential debate, as Paul mentioned. Jeb Bush was facing a lot of questions about the future of his campaign. It was quite a, from what I could see, it was quite a mob scene at this clam shack the other day. It's interesting. I've been watching Jeb Bush for about a year now. And there's this sort of constant drumbeat that he kind of needs to up his game. And it's not clear to me that there is necessarily some other level to which he can take his campaign. I think there's always a danger in trying to sort of reinvent yourself every time critics are unhappy with how you campaign. He seems to kind of understand that. I think he's in it for the long haul. They still have the money. They still have the organization. He has cut staff and salary, which was another set of decisions that fed into this idea that his campaign is faltering. The upshot of all this is they have said, the campaign has said, that part of this is kind of a refocusing, and that they intend to spend more time in New Hampshire.
As Paul said, yeah, and he'll be back here on Tuesday and spending some time right after that debate. Kathleen, you were also in that rather crowded clam shack.
Yes. A couple interesting things. First of all, a candidate never wants to be in a position when they're having to stand there and say to reporters, my campaign is not on life support, which is what Jeb Bush said to reporters yesterday. So, he does have this kind of cheerful and optimistic tone that he's continued to have. He doesn't look noticeably upset, but that having to put out that message saying, this is not over, don't write the obituary, that's, no candidate wants to be in that position. And I also thought it was interesting that for the first time yesterday, they rolled out this new campaign slogan that they had on this banner that said Jeb can fix it. And of course, what they're talking about is, Jeb's ability to come into Washington to fix the culture. They point to his record in Florida of achievement. But, there's another way that you could look at the phrase Jeb can fix it.
When
we're seeing
all of
these stories about, him having to cut staff or people getting nervous. But, on the flip side of that, I talked to a lot of voters who came out to see him yesterday, and many of them were saying, I like him and I'm not worried about this. It is still early. So voters on the ground in New Hampshire are saying, 3 months out is still pretty early. I don't necessarily think we have to be concerned about this yet. So I think, there's a whole range of ideas on whether or not Jeb Bush should
Kathleen,
be concerned.
That's the pitfall for his campaign. What does it mean to fix it? And different people have different ideas. And I've seen it before with other candidates over the years where, there's sort of this kind of media narrative that the campaign is faltering and, the donors are getting restless. You hear these sort of one story after the next. And candidates start to try to kind of constantly reinvent themselves, be someone or something that they're not. And then that ends up sort of having a spiraling rolling effect downward.
But he's not fixing it, though. That's the thing. Right. I asked him specifically yesterday. Yeah. He basically said, I'm going to do more of what I'm doing. I'm going to accelerate what I'm doing.
Sort of not clear what fixing it means necessarily.
And here's the other interesting thing. Listen, Bush's father, former President George Herbert Walker Bush, also campaigned right there at Geno's when he was running for the White House many years ago. In those days, you could run on experience and you could run on resume, which is what George or what Jeb Bush is doing. These days, especially with a Republican electorate that is so mad as you know what at Washington and politicians, running on resume, running on experience, it doesn't work anymore. It's not working for Jeb Bush. It may not work for John Kasich.
Go ahead, Kathleen, and then I have another question for you, Dean. Yeah.
And just another point that I wanted to point out from talking to voters is that I didn't talk to a single voter who said that they thought it was a good idea for Jeb Bush to go after Marco Rubio on his attendance record like he did on the debate stage. If you recall, he said that, you know, if you're not going to show up to work, you should resign effectively. And I talked to several voters there who said, you know, that was bad advice from his staff. And then I talked to somebody else who said if he was going to do that, he should have done it 100% because Rubio hit back on him and, you know, essentially said, well, clearly someone told you that attacking me is the way to save your campaign. And Bush didn't really have a response. And I talked to one voter who, you know, told me already that he's not supporting Bush. But he said, you know, he hit Rubio. Rubio came back at him and Bush melted. That's the word that the guy used. And he said, I think it was bad advice, but if you're going to do it, you better do it. And so that was not a great moment for Bush on the debate stage.
I don't think his heart was in it. I think you're right. I think somebody advised him that he needed to do it. And it looked really – it looked forced. It looked uncomfortable. And it's just sort of I agree. I just think it's sort of bad advice. You're not going to beat him on that particular issue. Candidates always miss votes when they run for president, some more than others. Sometimes that's a sign of viability. Sometimes not. We could debate that. But absolutely, it just sort of landed like a brick.
It was one of the most talked about moments on social media from the debate. Bush was by far the loser on that one. And as Kathleen said, voters feel the same way.
Well, Dean, to this sort of media narrative, this piling on of, you know, Jeb Bush and is he, you know, faltering. We saw similar media narrative surrounding John McCain years back. And then he sort of pulled it together, fixed it, to use that term, and came back to win the nomination.
Yeah, you know, but I've been thinking about that because I have heard the John McCain comparison. You know, that's part what Rubio used to defend the missed votes. And, you know, McCain was had already, you know, when he turned things around in 08, he had already won here big in 2000. So he had kind of a deep well of supporters, and he was sort of well liked and well known. He's also a different style of politician, and so you know, I don't know that the comparison is necessarily a perfect one, but that has been what we've been hearing. But when you're running for president, the reality is you're going to miss votes.
Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. In this segment of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, we're catching up on some of the big political news around the Granite State this week, including, of course, presidential candidates coming to New Hampshire, talking to voters, 1-800-892-6477. So Kathleen and Paul and Dean, in that clip we heard from Bush, he mentions it's not about the big personalities on the stage. Paul, I'm assuming he's talking about Donald Trump there.
Well, he's talking about Donald Trump, and he admitted his own shortcomings. He goes, I'm not that kind of person. I'm not a great talker. I'm a doer. As for Trump, it was interesting. We saw Trump here on Monday. He was at Atkinson Country Club for a town hall. 7 a.m., he had over 1,000 people there.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive for 7 a.m. You talk to his supporters, they're not there just to, you know, just to see a television celebrity. They're there because they're mad. They're mad as you know what, and they think Donald Trump could be the answer because he's the anti-politician. Trump, though, was but interestingly, kind of absent from the debate the other night. He wasn't the star of the debate for the first time. But he's still, listen, poll position-wise, he's still doing just fine. He's number one by far here in New Hampshire. If you average all the national polls together, he is still ahead of Ben Carson. And he's got a lot of money that he can spend, which he hasn't spent yet. That is probably the most poignant, the most interesting thing. He's got the bucks that he hasn't even spent yet that he can use if he needs them.
Well, at that rally in Atkinson, and wow, 7 a.m., I didn't realize
that,
Paul.
It was early, yeah.
He got some questions from the audience, including this one. A member of the audience asked Donald Trump how he'd maintain relations with world leaders, given both his inexperience and his tendency to forego what he calls political correctness. Let's hear how Donald Trump responded to that question of to whether he has the right temperament to be a world leader.
I've dealt with politicians all of my life. and I've gotten along. I have an international company. I deal with prime ministers. I deal with the biggest people in countries all over the world. I have great relationships with them. I think maybe that would be another misconception if you want to go back to the previous question.
Again, Donald Trump speaking in New Hampshire this week. Dean, what's your assessment of the Donald Trump campaign here in the Granite State?
I mean, that's that argument we just heard is an argument he's been making for a long time. It's the same argument that Carly Fiorina makes about her experience as a CEO dealing with world leaders. You know, the biggest question for Trump, and, you know, he's still doing well here. He's slipped a bit in Iowa, but Iowa is a fundamentally different – the caucus is a different electorate. It's heavily evangelical, which certainly helps Ben Carson, who's leading there. You know, here it's somewhat different. You know, the biggest question for me with Trump, particularly in the caucus states, but also in general, is can he convert this kind of outsider anger and angst and energy in the way the Tea Party was able to in 2010, can he convert that into votes at the ballot box? And you know, there's a primary history is full of candidates, and the caucus history in Iowa as well. Candidates who tapped into something in the voter zeitgeist, but then for whatever reason, it just does not translate into votes or caucusing. And that's the outstanding question. When push comes to shove, are people in large numbers really going to vote for Ben Carson, for Donald Trump, or are they going to fall back on sort of the more traditional candidate like a Jeb Bush or a Chris Christie or John Kasich or even a Marco Rubio? We don't know. We also, there are other, you know, we haven't mentioned Ted Cruz. He had a really good night at the debate as well. He's consolidating conservative support as well. And that's sort of something that Trump may have to contend with at some point.
Go ahead, Paul.
Here's the story you don't hear about with Donald Trump. When he comes here, of course, he gets all the media coverage of the world, huge crowds, yada, yada, yada. But away from the camera, when Trump isn't here, he's actually got a campaign structure here that is as big as Jeb Bush's. He's got 10 full-time staffers here in the state. I just visited his office in Newmarket. He's now got three offices, Keene, Newmarket, and the HQ in Manchester. So they are actually doing the work that needs to be done, getting the supporters, helping them out, building the grassroots. And that's the story that really isn't told, because that's what's going to win the New Hampshire primary.
That'll make a difference,
yep. That is what makes the difference here in New Hampshire.
Well, and I see the Trump signs, you know, around town and so forth. So it isn't just a big media thing, Paul. That seems to be what you're saying. Yep. Paul, you also spent some time with Hillary Clinton this week. She was here making some news with her comments, Paul, about the death penalty. Now, how did that come up?
Came up with a question from the audience, and I was talking with my colleagues from the National Press Corps who follow her nonstop. That's their only job. It was the first time they say she has really talked at all about the death penalty, first time she's gotten a question about it, first time she talked about it. Specifically with the federal death penalty, she said she would not call to abolish it, but she wants to limit it. To just keep it to terrorism cases and other related incidents, she said, like the Boston Marathon bombing. I asked her that specifically in the one-on-one interview. This is some daylight between her and Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley. They want to abolish the federal death penalty in all cases. You heard Bernie Sanders come back yesterday on the floor of the Senate to talk about that and point that out. So just like she goes after him over gun control, he's going to go after her over the death penalty, and he's back today, and we'll have a chance to ask him about that.
Right. He's back in New Hampshire. I think he's in Manchester.
Starting today, yeah.
Sure. Kathleen.
Yeah, just to that point, Bernie Sanders is starting to draw sharper contrasts with Clinton on positions. You know, he says that he does not plan to go negative. He says he's never run a negative ad in any of his campaigns, and he doesn't plan to do that. But he's making a difference between, you know, negative character attacks and showing the daylight on these positions here. Both he and Martin O'Malley have, you know, been going after Clinton very strongly on Wall Street, saying that she's not going to be able to push them. Now they have this death penalty opportunity, and they both came out very strongly in defense of getting rid of the death penalty. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, now that Clinton seems to have a little bit of momentum, what Sanders does to try and stop that and to try and get back ahead. And we'll probably start to see some of that a little bit today in New Hampshire as he is here. And it'll be interesting to see how he walks that line of drawing a contrast without going negative per se, which is something he says that he does not want to do.
Mm-hmm. You could definitely sense, though, from Hillary Clinton and her supporters some relief and a lot more enthusiasm when we saw her the other day at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, the largest politics and eggs to date, over 500 people there. Listen, she had an extremely good October. Three big hurdles. She passed them all. A very good debate performance. She held her own at the Benghazi hearing. And guess what? Vice President Biden said, I'm not running. this October was an October she needed after a lot of bad months.
Well, another issue that came up that, again, hasn't gotten a lot of play in this Democratic primary so far, in addition to the death penalty, is the idea of what happened with the Veterans Administration a couple years ago. Everybody here knows there were some serious concerns about the health care that American veterans were receiving, people dying while waiting for treatment. Hillary Clinton was asked about this as well on the campaign trail. Let's hear her response to the criticisms of the Veterans Administration.
I think we need a top-to-bottom review of what goes on in the VA, and things that are wrong need to be fixed. But I was attempting to say that there are some who want to use the problems in the VA as an excuse to abolish the VA, and I don't believe that.
Again, that's from your interview, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was her answer to when I asked her about that. She got criticized by Republicans left and right over those initial comments she made a week ago today. And she basically was saying I was being inartful and trying to kind of correct the situation. A huge issue here in this state. She realizes that.
Yeah, Kathleen.
Yeah, I don't think I've been to a single town hall with a Republican candidate where a question about veterans and the services they receive has not come up. It usually comes from a veteran who has something to say about how veterans aren't getting the help that they need. They're not getting the health care that they need. People are upset. There are veterans out there who are very upset about what happened in the VA. And, you know, Clinton, of course, in that interview with NH1, did try to clarify her remarks. But for a lot of veteran voters out there, this is a very important issue to them. And you can tell just by the amount of I think that's probably the issue that comes up most or most frequently at town hall events that I have been to. It always comes up at every single one. And the people asking the questions are upset about it. So it's something that, you know, candidates really have to be careful when they're talking about.
Well, and Dean, it makes sense, right? New Hampshire, we've talked about this before, has a high concentration of active duty and retired military personnel.
Yeah, this is a big issue. I've had a similar experience, as Kathleen mentioned, that whenever Republicans are out on the stump, they're have very strong push this sort of issue of reform and perhaps getting rid of the VA, or they talk about giving all veterans medical cards that they can then use for medical care anywhere in the country. It's a big issue. You know, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton had to be careful to not sound like she was kind of politicizing it or downplaying it. I think given the experience we've had with Afghanistan and Iraq and a lot of the returning veterans and all the health, mental health and physical health issues that have gone along with that, you have to be careful about downplaying it.
Sure. Kathleen, go ahead.
And it's also an issue that has been bipartisan. You know, Bernie Sanders and John McCain worked on that big piece of legislation together on reform. Gene Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte worked as part of that to expand services for veterans in New Hampshire. So it's interesting that the work in Congress tends to be bipartisan, but out on the trail, you know, Clinton's willing to say Republicans are overblowing this, whereas Republicans are willing to say Barack Obama doesn't take this seriously. So we see this kind of partisan blame out on the campaign trail, but a bipartisan willingness to really try and fix this, at least in the Senate, when we saw the McCain-Sanders bill.
Paul, I know you got to go. Final thoughts from you on who you're going to be covering on the campaign trail next week and over the weekend.
Over the weekend, it's all about my two little kids at Halloween.
Good.
So I'm taking a couple days off. It's going to be an extremely busy week. We got Jeb Bush back. We've got Rand Paul back. I've got a list that goes on. It's, you know, we're all going to be extremely busy between now and February 9th. So.
All right. Well, Paul, always good to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. That's Paul Steinhauser. Again, he's anchor and chief correspondent for NH1 News. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more politics, including a new ad from Kelly Ayotte touting her bipartisan credentials. We'll also find out about a wide-ranging group from around the country talking about sea level rise, gathering at New Hampshire's seacoast. That's all coming up. We'll find out more on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-64. 877. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. This week, our guests are Kathleen Ronayne, Statehouse reporter for the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And both of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Neil is calling from where? Hi, Neil. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Good morning, Laura. I'd like to shed some more light on some of the comments that were made in the first segment about the state budget, specifically the Sununu Center and the retiree health care costs. I'm chairman of the House Finance Committee, and I was there at the inception, so to speak. The Sununu Center reductions were not arbitrary. They were based on comparable costs of sending all of the kids out to private community-based treatment. As you know, when a school shrinks, the budget doesn't shrink proportionately, and the same thing is happening to the Sununu Center. So we told them, either you folks have to figure out ways to reduce your costs, or you can close the facility and send the students, or some of the students, out into the community. So the number was calculated very simply. We learned from the department that it costs $525 a day per student to send them to the private sector. We multiplied that by the number of students times the number of days in a year, and that's how we came out with our number. So it wasn't arbitrary. It was thoughtful and considered. The other issue had to do with the retiree health care costs. Again, that wasn't arbitrary. The governor knowingly, and we went along with it, shorted the retirees roughly $5 million. She appropriated $140 million, and the true cost at that time was $145. But it turned out, unbeknownst to anyone at the time, that prescription drug costs were going to drive retiree health care costs up by another $5 million. So part of the problem is due to the fact that we intentionally decided to transfer costs to the retirees by appropriating less than the full amount we knew was necessary at the time. And part of it was due to the fact that there were just other costs that were unknown at the time.
All right.
So I thought your listeners would like to know that the legislature does deal thoughtfully with the budget. You may agree or disagree, but these were not arbitrary decisions.
Well, good to hear from the chair of the House Finance Committee calling in on the roundup. Kathleen, you want to jump in real quick, and then we'll move on to a couple other stories.
Yeah, I'll just say to Representative Kirk's point, perhaps arbitrary was the wrong word choice on my end. I think the point that I was trying to make was that for the Sununu Center, this appropriation was put in place without a specific plan of exactly how the center was going to get there, and it's proved to be difficult to find how they are going to meet that number. And, you know, on the retiree health care plan as well, there were some unforeseen costs, as Representative Kirk mentioned, and lawmakers are now in a point where they're trying to figure out how do we meet the appropriation that we set in the budget. So maybe wrong word choice on my end, but I think there are still a lot of questions on how we get to those targets set in the budget.
Chairman Kirk, thanks for calling in. You can join us, too, on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us now with an update on a national conference on climate change and sea level rise held in Hampton, New Hampshire this week is NHPR environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown. And Sam, thank you very much for taking time out.
Hey, no, happy to be here.
Well, lots of conferences on climate change and sea level rise. Sam, what was different about this one?
Well, what was different about this one is it came to a state that only has 13 miles of coast, which, you know, one might ask why. And it was really targeted at generating conversation in the presidential primary. So we had, you know, 35 plus mayors and elected representatives from, you know, Mississippi and California and the Carolinas all converging on New Hampshire to talk about their problems from both parties, actually more Republicans than Democrats. All sort of clamoring for most of them looking for federal dollars to deal with their local flooding issues, and trying to shift the conversation in the presidential campaign, trying to bring some attention to it, and you know we'll sort of see if they had any success.
No presidential candidates showed up, to their consternation.
None showed up, and actually it was of note, Jeb Bush was here yesterday, and yesterday was the King Tide, which some might know about, which is this sort of confluence of a number of factors leads to a very, very high tide. A lot of people say, you know, this is sort of a sign of what's to come. And Jeb Bush was on the seacoast, you know, standing, you know, they had to put out hay bales to keep the waters back, and no mention of sea level rise while he was here.
Well, the thing that I found interesting from your report on this, Sam, is, you know, you look at the headline and you think, yeah, it's the usual suspects, you know, the climate scientists and so forth. But this was, you know, on the ground folks, I mean, mayors from around the country, from these little cities, including, as you said, more Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah. And you know, the Republicans talked about how the challenge for them was how to communicate their concern without talking about climate change and global warming. And so a lot of for them, the sort of semantics were really important. In order to get bills passed in the Carolinas, for instance, the bill had to be about nuisance flooding or recurrent flooding and not mention perhaps the cause of that flooding.
So where does this group go from here? They came to New Hampshire. They spoke about their concerns. They said that, you know, a lot of 123 million Americans live in coastal areas and could be affected by this. They hoped to hear from the presidential candidates. Nobody showed up. So where do they go from here with this?
You know, that's a very reasonable question. It could be that it doesn't go anywhere from here. We're just going to have to wait and see. I think the Union of Concerned Scientists is the group that organized it along with the World Resources Institute. So they're obviously going to be sort of ringing this bell over and over for as long as they, you know, people are interested in hearing about it. It's just a question of how long it takes before that gains any sort of political traction.
Yeah, I do wonder if these coastal communities, again, a very mixed group, you know, that fiery mayor from Hoboken, New Jersey, whose town was, you know, almost wiped out by storms, and these mayors from these sort of sleepy southern cities who got hit by Hurricane Katrina and so forth. I wonder if they're going to, you know, form a group and become like the Coalition of Concerned Coastal Communities or something.
Well, you know, I think the lobbying is happening. I don't know. You know, I'm not in Washington. I'm down here up here in New Hampshire. It's an interesting question as to whether it's an organized and concerted effort, because it's one of those things. I mean, it is true that 50% of the GDP comes from these coastal communities, but it is still just the coast. You know, it's this string of a few miles around the whole country, and the rest of the country doesn't have to deal with these problems. So it can be very easy to just dismiss this as a local concern and you know, argue that it shouldn't be dealt with at the federal level.
All right. Well, Sam, thank you very much. It's an interesting story.
Thanks for having me.
That's NHPR environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Speaking of the environment and climate change and so forth, Dean Spiliotis, Kelly Ayotte getting on the bandwagon for climate change, coming out in favor of the Clean Power Act this week and really touting her support for environmental causes.
Yeah, this is getting a lot of visibility because she's the first Republican senator to back these new EPA regulations. The Obama administration has promulgated these new regulations that are designed to cut carbon emissions by 32% by 2030. Pretty aggressive standards. Jean Shaheen, our other senator, also backs this. Now, there are individual emissions reduction goals for different states. As you know, New Hampshire is already part of the REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, so we've made some progress on this. This is a very popular issue with New Hampshire voters. We tend to have a lot of interest in the environment, a lot of interest in dealing with these sorts of emissions issues. Democrats are arguing that this is sort of a predictable election year position taking by Senator Ayotte, and they point out that she blocked an earlier amendment that would deny highway funds to any states that don't submit a required emissions reduction plan. You have to submit a plan. And so some were pushing for a loss of highway funds if you don't submit this plan. She was
to put a little more teeth in it.
Yeah. So she's one of the senators who blocked this. But nonetheless, she's been getting out in front on it, getting a lot of publicity. I think it's going to be the kind of thing that is going to resonate here in a statewide race for sure.
Kathleen.
Yeah, I will note that Ayotte did tell the Concord Monitor that she voted against that bill dealing with the highway funds because she didn't think, you know, tying highway right. funds to climate sure. change was the appropriate way to go. So that's the, you know, defense that she offered to the Concord Monitor for that vote. But what's interesting here is Governor Hassan, you know, wrote a letter to the whole congressional delegation. I think it was at the end of last week saying, you know, I urge you to do whatever you can to ensure that that the Clean Power Plan gets through. And Kelly Ayotte at that point had not taken a position. So she comes out Sunday and takes a position. And just politically, you know, at first it looks like, well, she's clearly responding to Hassan. She's trying to neutralize this as an issue. And then we saw all these environmental groups, Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, come out and praise Ayotte. And this, and Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen held their own press conference talking about it. But the story of the day Monday kind of became Ayotte's the first Republican to back this. All these environmental groups are cheering her. So Ayotte got some pretty good headlines out of that. Yep. And I don't know if that is, you know, it was just interesting politically to see it, because it was, you know, Hassan that first said, hey, congressional delegation, come out and back this. Hassan's been supporting this for a while, and Ayotte's the one who got the good headlines. And, you know, a lot of people think she's just trying to neutralize this as a general election issue. But it is something that it is going to anger, you know, parts of the Republican base, people who don't believe in climate change, or people who don't think that the government should have a role in it, or that the EPA is run amok. So it's a political calculation Ayotte's making.
There are real economic incentives here. I know there's something like half the states are filing, you know, legal action to block this because, you know, they worry it's going to decimate, you know, jobs in the energy sector.
Yeah. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, Republican Senate Majority Leader, has encouraged states not to follow this. So she really is going against her own party quite a bit on this.
Well, and at that No Labels conference a couple weeks ago, Dean Spiliotis, we talked about this. Kelly Ayotte appeared talking about how, you know, the hardest vote sometimes to take is the vote that bucks your own party. So here she is providing an example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's the issue is going to be, you know, do voters believe that this is sort of typically where she is, kind of from a ideological positioning perspective, or is this something she's doing for electing your politics? I mean, that's really something for voters to decide. Democrats are going to argue it's positioning. She's going to argue it's kind of her natural support for these environmental issues.
Well, and she pretty quickly after that vote came out with an ad telling New Hampshire voters about why she did what she did. Let's just hear a little bit of that ad.
As your attorney general, I fought to protect New Hampshire from out-of-state polluters. And I've done the same in the Senate, crossing the aisle to protect New Hampshire's clean air and water.
Now I'm supporting the Clean Power Plan, which will help address climate change with clean energy solutions that preserve our environment.
Again, that's a recent ad from Senator Kelly Ayotte. One more question about this. Kathleen, to you, you know, Democrats have said that this is sort of Kelly Ayotte changing her stripes from 2010, where she was seen as sort of a Tea Party favorite. Now she's, you know, coming out week by week with all these bipartisan credentials. How are voters going to kind of shake that out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, over the course of the campaign, you know, we as reporters are going to try and do our best to give voters a look at her entire record. I mean, you know, a career or a term in the Senate is 6 years, so that's quite a bit of time. You know, at the beginning, you know, Ayotte was elected in 2010, a big Republican wave year. She has, you know, stood with Republicans on some issues regarding, you know, gun control, particularly was a very unpopular vote that she took here in New Hampshire. But then again, if you do look at, you know, all the various analysis that different groups do, she is one of the senators who is, you know, the most likely to not side with her party. I mean, I think it's still a pretty low percentage, but she's one of the people more likely to cross party lines. And, you know, her and Senator Shaheen have worked together on quite a bit of legislation. So I think that, you know, on some issues, Kelly Ayotte has a bipartisan record. On some issues, she doesn't. I think that's any politician. I think, you know, what's interesting here is she's trying to be this bipartisan senator. Maggie Hassan's trying to be this bipartisan governor. It's, you know, the war of who can be more bipartisan, right? And, on the, you know, with Hassan on the same—
That's a switch from most of the
right,
politics
and on
we
the
see
same
these days.
Thing,
certainly
you
different
with,
from the presidential level.
Yes.
Now.
Right. And with Governor Hassan, you know, we see the same thing. You know, the Republicans are coming out and saying, you know, you're a hardcore leftist Democrat and you're trying to claim these bipartisan credentials that you don't have. You know, you look at her record on some issues, she is very in line with her party. On some issues, you know, she has worked with Republicans. So I think that, you know, it's not, you can't say they either are or aren't bipartisan. It's about looking at the full record. And I think that's something that's going to come out. I mean, we're still more than a year away from this election day. So there's a lot of reporting to do on the records that both of them have had during their time in office.
Sure. And how active a candidate has Governor Hassan been as a U.S. Senate candidate, Dean, thus far? I mean, Kelly Ayotte has been promoting these votes and releasing ads. Governor Hassan, has she been actively campaigning or
yeah,
not
she's
really?
She's starting to ramp up. I think, you know, we went through that whole long period of waiting when they were trying to come up with a solution for the state budget. I definitely think she's sort of, making the shift to senatorial candidate, which I think will take a little bit of time. But sure, you're hearing her out there now, sort of taking stronger positions. And, a lot of times initially you'll have surrogates go after your opponent and then kind of ease into being on the attack yourself. So, yeah, I think she's absolutely ramping up as well.
Well, speaking of Governor Hassan, here's a headline from the Concord Monitor. Lawmakers agree on drug epidemic focus, but are divided on best path forward. Again, this is from the Concord Monitor. Governor Maggie Hassan and Republicans are calling for action on the state's heroin epidemic, but they differ on how best to move forward. Kathleen, your thoughts there?
Yeah, so earlier this week, the governor, put out a release of some legislation that she would like to see happen next year. Then Republican leadership in the House and Senate held a press conference about legislation that they would like to see. There are some similarities on the agendas that both are pushing. Senator Jeb Bradley is working. He says he's working with Hassan on a bill that would make the penalties for selling or distributing fentanyl the same as heroin. Right now, fentanyl, which is actually causing the most overdose deaths in New
right.
Hampshire, is not treated the same way that heroin is. There's agreement on the need to expand drug courts. There's an agreement on the need to support law enforcement. Where we're seeing some differences is, the governor wants to push for stricter prescription drug prescribing rules quickly. Republicans are saying, we need to step back and not do that quite so fast. Both sides agree that, this needs to be the priority. But again, what's interesting to me is that, we have both sides saying that they want to work with the other in a bipartisan fashion. But what we haven't seen is Democrats and Republicans holding a press conference and saying, we all feel that this is a priority. Here's how we're going to do it together. Everybody wants credit and they want their own credit on this issue.
Well, and next week we will be taking a look at drug courts on the exchange in addition to a bunch of other shows. Dean, how about you? What are you going to be following next week?
Well, the filing period for the New Hampshire primary starts on Thursday, I believe. So there's going to be a parade of candidates posing in Bill Gardner's office at the State House. So just kind of seeing, what the impact of that kind of moment is on the different campaigns.
Yeah, not that far away, Dean. Okay.
Nope, couple days.
Lots of cameras, lots of fanfare. Yep. How about you, Kathleen?
I'll be watching the same thing. I think some of the candidates are really going to try and pull out all the stops, get the headlines. So what do they do that's creative? Who makes the biggest splash?
Okay. Both of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
Kathleen Ronayne, she's State House reporter for the Associated Press. Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Mikesell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our intern is Hallie Loft. And I'm Laura Kanoy.